Today on the Rising Coaches podcast.
It's what you emphasize gets done. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be measured, but measuring something and then either showing it to the guys or showing it to your coaching staff does have an impact on your psyche and your ability to do that thing. And so why wouldn't you measure it in the best way possible?
Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches podcast. This is Adam Gordon, and today we are joined by Jordan Sperber of Hoop Vision. Jordan started Hoop Vision while he was in high school as a blog and a Twitter handle, and now today is one of the most trusted sources in basketball analytics. We talk about Jordan's journey through coaching, through basketball analytics, how he discovered it, how he found a passion for it, and how he carved out his niche in the world of analytics in basketball. We have a great conversation. We hope you enjoy. If you do, please subscribe, write us a review, please tell your friends, and please follow along with what we are doing at risingcoaches.com. Before we get into today's podcast, I want to take a minute to tell you about the Two Coaches a Month program. This is an initiative that we created for our members to help them make meaningful, genuine relationships with other coaches in the industry. Everyone knows it's a relationship business. Everybody wants to expand their network. Everybody wants to know what they can do to get ahead. Here's a solution. On the 1st and 15th of every month, we pair up two coaches. We give them a topic of discussion, and the expectation is that they spend a minimum of 10 minutes on the phone with each other, getting to know each other, and brainstorming on that week's topic. If you do it for a year, you'll meet 24 new coaches. Pretty simple, pretty effective. And just one of the many perks that you'll receive when you sign up for a Rising Coaches membership. The membership is $120 a year, and you can find out more information by visiting risingcoaches.com/membership. Jordan, what's up, buddy? Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Adam. I've listened to the pod in the past quite a few times, and I'm happy to be on.
Yeah, we're happy to have you and excited to get into this conversation because, you know, I think you specialize in an area that's really underutilized and I think people kind of don't know where to start when it comes to analytics. So excited for you to break it down for us all.
Thank you. Yeah. I think that first part you said about don't know where to start is kind of right. I've had some coaches reach out to me, and they actually are very interested in the idea of analytics. And it's that, like, being able to apply it to what they do philosophically or on an everyday basis with their program that I think is still kind of lacking, except for, you know, the select few of coaches that are implementing it at a pretty high level. But for the most part, I think that the interest is there.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, every NBA program and professional team utilizes it probably at a pretty high level. But for whatever reason, like you just said, it hasn't really trickled down in terms of an implementation standpoint in college hoops. So you seem to be on a quest to change that.
I guess I'm trying, yeah.
Yeah. Well, tell us how you got started. I mean, were you obviously an avid basketball fan growing up, but you started Hoop Vision when you were in high school, right?
Yeah. So I was a fan and a player, an okay player, growing up. I grew up in upstate New York at a pretty big public high school in terms of enrollment. And I was never in jeopardy of getting cut. I made the team every year. I was, a gym rat, probably like a lot of the coaches that listen to this podcast, pretty similar in terms of always being obsessed with basketball, not necessarily analytics. But I did like math. And in high school, I took a statistics class and I really got into baseball. Statistics, analytics, the whole money ball deal. Baseball was my second sport, and it was kind of just a matter of time until I got hooked onto basketball analytics, read Dean Oliver's Basketball on Paper, got really into Ken Pomeroy's work, and it was kind of the time of the blog era. So I I started a blog and a Twitter account that nobody was reading. But later on in college, used it as a networking tool to break into the college basketball business.
So what year is this, by the way? What year do you start Hoop Vision with the blog?
I graduated high school in 2011, so I think the blog is either 2009 or 2010.
So right when Twitter's getting started, right?
Yep, that's right.
So you create an account, you've got your website, which probably doesn't have a ton of traffic on it, but are you pretty consistent with it, or in the beginning was it just kind of like, you know, when you felt like it, you know, kind of random posts here and there?
Yeah, so I think I started it my junior year, probably after the basketball season ended. And that summer, which is the worst time to do college basketball content, but I was pretty consistent with it. I had a bunch of like, at the time, every basketball analytics blog had an explanation of the four factors. It was like a rite of passage for a basketball analytics blog. And so I did that. I was trying to do some X's and O's stuff, so I was always very interested in that. I was on coaching message boards even before Twitter, like trading championship production DVDs or the files with people when I was in high school, and you know, watching them and taking notes and things like that. And
don't tell the guys at Championship Productions that they're gonna come after you now.
Yeah, I was 15, so not their target audience. I don't think. But you're absolutely right. As someone who now relies on subscriptions and things like that, I can sympathize with that. But I never had played for a Pac-Line defense team, but I watched the Dick Bennett Pac-Line defense DVD and things like that. And so I tried to incorporate that into Hoop Vision a little bit in high school, but I really was not very good at that. I think analytics, if you've taken a statistics course or something like that, the barrier of entry, I mean, to get something decent out on a blog is a little bit easier than the X's and O's being a 16-year-old kid that doesn't really know a whole lot. But then, yeah, my senior year, my senior season, I had a really good year kind of out of nowhere. And I put the blog away pretty much during that season, and then picked up in college where I did start treating it as a hobby, but a dedicated hobby where during the season I was trying to write it. Post a couple times a week and tweet some stuff, and it caught the eyes of some D1 coaches.
And what was like the end goal for you? Were you trying to be a coach at that point? Did you know you wanted, you know, to be involved in basketball, but not necessarily on the sidelines, maybe more front office or analytics? You know, what was kind of the goal in mind?
Yes. So I heard you on a podcast talking about something similar to like your motivations behind coaching. And I could really relate to it. Not that we have the same, but just kind of your thought process around it. I never really wanted to be a basketball coach. I did not want to be a basketball coach, but it wasn't like, you know, I've read stories of like Josh Pastner, Buzz Williams, who were like 15 years old and dedicated to becoming a basketball coach. I think if you asked like high school or college me, my default answer was, I want to make decent money working in basketball. That was all the detail that I gave. And beyond that, so I named my podcast, which I started over a year ago now, called Solving Basketball. And that was kind of like the mantra of high school or college me. was trying to learn as much as possible about the game. I think at one point, maybe I wanted to be a writer. I have wanted to coach in the past. And I've done a lot of player development stuff, which does not fit the profile of a analytics guy. But it's always the game has always been, the number one thing, not necessarily the coaching profession.
Got it. And so where does your first kind of professional opportunity for you start after you graduate from Villanova?
Yeah, so at Villanova, I had done some analytics consulting for Paul Weir, who was the associate head coach at New Mexico State at the time. And
did he just find your blog or your Twitter page or what?
Yeah, he emailed me. I think it was off of Twitter. So the first two coaches that emailed me were Eric Musselman and Paul Weir. I can't remember in what order it was, but Paul, it was definitely with consulting in mind, I think. For those that don't know Paul, he's got a very academic background. He's has a PhD now and a bunch of master's degrees, and he's definitely into the statistics side of things. I think he wanted to know if I was going to the Final Four to potentially lead to work. Musk kind of just emailed me like, great job, with something that he had read, not really looking for anything. I am not the best networker, another important skill of being a, of being in the basketball industry or the coaching industry. And so I kind of lost touch with Musk, for a couple years, he got the head job at Nevada, and there was a grad assistant position open on Hoop Dirt. And I applied for it. And fortunately, the director of basketball operations at the time, Anthony Ruta, was with Musk at Arizona State. And he was the one that kind of remembered me from that initial interaction, from the blog days, and that led to, you know, some kind of like phone interview type stuff and my first job.
All right, let's go back to the blog days, because I still got to wrap, I'm still trying to wrap my head around this.
Yeah.
So what are, you know, I know what your breakdowns look like now on Hoop Vision, and you know, you got great content. You know, you're breaking down film and putting it right on your platforms. Back in those days, I mean, are you breaking down certain games? Are you using video? Are you just writing about it and doing special projects on your own? What kind of things are you diving into?
Yeah. So the blog actually, there was two websites. The first ever Hoop Vision website is hoopvision.blogspot.com, and it still exists. It's pretty bad. I think that some of the statistics stuff I could read without like cringing. Probably the video and the X's and O's stuff, I would, there'd be a lot of cringing going on. This is kind of a little known thing, but my Twitter account is HoopVision68, because Hoop Vision was taken, but the 68 was my blog was supposed to be that I would cover any team that had a realistic shot at making the NCAA tournament. So at the time, I was a big fan of mid-major basketball. I grew up in Albany, and Albany and Siena were both pretty good while I was in like middle school and high school. So I was a big mid-major fan. I wanted to cover mid-majors. I think the X's and O's, the first thing I did was on Utah State and Stu Morrill. And it was basically just like looking at one play. It's something now that, it would not meet the standards of a Hoop Vision tweet or anything like that nowadays. But there was a couple of decent ideas statistics wise. I can remember Zach Beauvert was an early reader, and he had a newsletter or maybe through Iona, they had a newsletter. And he linked to a pretty early on piece of the effects of offense on defense. So I was looking at how shooting changed after a team gets a turnover versus a rebound. So I was doing mostly stats things without kind of the like detailed coaching stuff.
And like, where were you getting your data from to do? Were you just charting games yourself?
I actually, yeah. So That was a big thing for me at first was charting. There was a competition that I did in college through teamrankings.com, which is kind of like they're not just college basketball, but they put out their own efficiency rankings like a KenPom does. And they had this competition called Stat Geek Idol, which is the nerdiest sounding thing ever in college. And it was during the NCAA tournament. They sell this bracket strategy thing, and basically they wanted to drive traffic towards their site, so they put a competition out there where anyone could write a college basketball related analytics project, and the judges were the most interesting part of it all. Like Mark Cuban was a judge, and Ken Pomeroy and Dean Oliver, they got all these judges. And the winner got like $1,000 or something like that. And so I for that, the first year of that competition, I was trying to figure out how I could win this, not, you know, competing against people with better analytics or statistics abilities than I do, you know, like people with PhDs and things like that. And so I did a ton of charting. I think I charted Wisconsin's offense. And that was kind of my year one approach. And I was the runner up that year. Over the years, I got a lot better at the data side of stuff, scraping data and computer programming. And so I was a little bit more competent in that area. And I did, for the record, become the Stat Geek Idol in year number two. So,
yeah, that's great. Congratulations. Did that come with a trophy, or do you have a plaque still on your wall?
It came with $2,000.
Oh, so nice. Even better.
19 or 20 year old me was very excited about that. Yeah.
Heck yeah. 35 year old me would be excited about that.
Fair enough.
So, all right. So you do some consulting work, you know, your blog and the early work you're doing as kind of an independent basketball analyst leads to some opportunities at New Mexico State as a consultant, and then as a GA at Nevada. Did I say that right?
Yep. So even though, you know, I went through the whole kind of interview process and that type of thing, it was a volunteer spot, which might sound crazy to someone outside of the industry, but not so much to people inside of it. I was a volunteer GA at Nevada for the 1 year.
Yeah. Does not sound crazy at all. I would say
like
90% of the people we have on this podcast at some point took a volunteer spot or something that paid under 10 grand. It's just kind of the cost of admission into coaching. So, you know, I'm thinking about a GA spot. Maybe yours is a little different because it's a volunteer deal, but, you know, most GA duties at Division I programs include, you know, all of the grunt work associated with basketball, lots of film breakdown, lots of player development on the court. Here you are, you know, like an analytical mind with a lot of analytics experience. Did they use you to your strengths? Were you given special projects to do? Were you doing that on your own anyways? Or was it a pretty typical GA experience?
It was in a lot of ways a typical GA experience. And then on top of it, definitely some specialized analytics stuff. So I was given some leeway to do some projects really that I came up with independently. That is one challenge, I think, for a college basketball program is a lot of times there is some micromanaging going on. And if you have someone with a different skill set than the manager, or in this case, the head coach, it might make sense to let that person kind of try to add value in ways that they see fit. Now, that being said, it was my first experience with a college team. I barely knew what I was doing. So I definitely did need some guidance. But to your point, I did do a lot of on-court stuff, which I didn't necessarily do as much at New Mexico State, where I was video. I remember after after I had been told that I got the GA gig, I think someone on the staff kind of casually asked me, like, so, you know, can you do anything on the court? And I didn't know what that meant. And when I got there, the GAs did have a pretty big role in Muss's kind of player development system. And whether it was real or not, I definitely felt like there was some type of stigma with the players at first, being the analytics guy, like, this guy's going to rebound for me or this guy's going to work me out. But that quickly went away, which I think I kind of tried to go out of my way to get rid of that stigma. I would challenge players to one-on-one and always trying to play. And so it was definitely a little bit of a unique thing, where it was a lot of player development and a lot of analytics, which is not the norm.
Yeah, for sure. And then, so after your GA there, you go back to New Mexico State in a full-time capacity as video coordinator. Does that happen kind of consecutively, or did you have a stop in between New Mexico State and Nevada?
Yeah, it was consecutively, excuse me. Actually, Paul Weir was, like I said, he was associate head coach at New Mexico State about a month or two before he got elevated to the head job. You know, Marvin Menzies left for UNLV. He was in Reno for some type of academic conference. And so that was the first time I met him in person, was just by strange coincidence. He was in Reno and we had a meal together. I think he might have had some idea that a job was coming open soon. I definitely didn't know. And so it was really good timing on that end that we had just kind of met face to face and we had the past history, and he was committed. I think that was a priority he had when he got his chance as a head coach, that he wanted to do something analytically. There was definitely some HR drama with making that happen. So it was still up in the air for about a month afterwards to make sure I met all the criterias and things like that. But it was kind of a coincidental thing that worked out well.
Was your title, did you have an analytics title, or were you the video coordinator?
I was video coordinator, and, you know, doing all of the video stuff. So at Nevada, our video coordinator was Rafi Goldman, and I had helped him a little bit with some sports code stuff, but definitely was lacking in that area for a video coordinator. I think, like anyone who has transitioned into that job, it was a rough like 2 or 3 months trying to figure everything out. Probably detracted from the amount of analytic stuff and really the reason why I was hired that I could do. And so year three of the business and year two at New Mexico State, when I had the sports code stuff kind of under control, that was when I really could do the most in terms of what I felt like was providing value, actually using sports code and incorporating it into the analytics stuff, where we were using the scripting side of sports code to basically combine what the video coordinator role and what the analytics role is in ways that like European soccer teams do it. So they don't have video coordinators in European soccer. They have what's called performance analysts. And I think, in my opinion, that is a potential role that college basketball coaches should consider not only hiring, but paying more than a video coordinator normally makes and getting someone with the right skill set. I am very biased, though, to make that assertion. So
when you say performance analyst, like, and you reference soccer, they're doing the work that a video coordinator would do. But more importantly, they're breaking it down from a player performance standpoint and looking for areas and patterns. Is that right? Or that, or did I shortchange it?
No, that's, yeah, that's definitely right. The thing that is sort of necessary to do that at a high level is technical skills. And in terms of being able to use sports code software, but even potentially computer programming or things like that, I'm definitely no expert on European soccer, but I think people go to school for that type of thing. But again, not an expert. But yeah, I know I'm telling you nothing new here, but for the listeners, for the most part, the person who's hired in the video coordinator role, or really all the support staff roles, are just aspiring coaches that want to get on the road as soon as possible and recruit. And that those incentives are a little bit different than taking your time to master sports code or master whatever the software is, and really like being an expert at your role.
Yeah, for sure.
And yeah, well, you go. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, I think there's a lot of people out there that would actually enjoy that separation from being lumped in with, you know, hey, this person wants to become a recruiting assistant. That's such a different deal than actually breaking down film, digging into the tactical pieces of the game. I mean, they're two completely different skill sets. And I think if they did a better job defining roles, I think you'd find that there's actually a lot of people who would be more comfortable doing something like that and not having to ever worry about, you know, the recruiting piece. And that holds people up in terms of, you know, job mobility. You know, that's always, you know, right? That's the big hurdle you got to jump over when you're trying to get your first assistant job is, you know, does he have recruiting experience? Who can he bring to the table? Well, if there was another designated role for you to put your skills into, I think people would enjoy that.
I definitely agree that there are maybe a big segment, or at least a segment of coaches that would prefer that track. As someone who's in that segment, I kind of evaluated it and I didn't see a precedent for anyone in that track career-wise to, you know, get promoted and make more money. It doesn't mean that it couldn't happen, especially, you know, developing a relationship with your boss and kind of moving up the ranks. But from a professional perspective, it probably right now makes sense to go be a JUCO assistant so you get that recruiting experience, or like the volunteer third assistant job in the Ivy League, or something like that. There's different ways to get that experience, and yeah, that's where you mentioned the NBA in the beginning, and there's a lot of reasons why the NBA has adapted analytics or technology better than college basketball. But the very basic reason is money. they are paying to get better talent than just the rising former manager, who, by the way, brings a ton of value to the program. But it's just a different role than kind of like that performance analyst or analytics type role.
For sure. I want to come back to those guys that you worked for and how they were using you in your role at New Mexico State and even in Nevada. But before we do that, you know, you touched on something that I want to, while we're talking about it, let's continue to kind of pull on that thread. For somebody who's interested in applying analytics to their college program where they're at, what can they do? What skills? I mean, first of all, do you have to be good at math? Because if you do, I'm out. You know, like, is that a prerequisite?
So you don't have to be good at math, but you also can't be afraid of math, I guess. that would be I think there's definitely, and this isn't just basketball, this might be like general society in aversion to math. And I think that thinking probabilistically as a coach, and that's not even saying that you're on the sidelines making decisions with a calculator or with a spreadsheet, but you just kind of have a better understanding of some of the very basic statistical concepts, which aren't necessarily numbers. Like regression to the mean is something that I think all coaches should understand. And it doesn't require numbers. It's a concept. And I think that would actually be a decent place to start, which I probably don't recommend that much as I should to coaches that ask this question. Reading a book, not even basketball specific, but you probably can find one or sports specific, about how numbers impact like the world, I guess, but also our decision making and things like that.
So for somebody that does want to do this and get started down this path for their program, I mean, every school's got a math program and has got math students and professors. Mm-hmm. I mean, should they be hitting up the math department and, you know, saying, hey, we got a internship here for any of your top students that would want to work with our team? I mean, is that a good place to start? Is that some free labor that any university would be able to take advantage of?
It definitely can't hurt. So I think there's some examples of that. Davidson College, I think Cat Stats is maybe like the program, and they provide analysis through a professor to, I think now it's expanded beyond just the men's basketball team to other teams in for the athletic department. To me, that needs to be with more long-term goals in mind. I'm not sure that you could contact a math professor, get some eager students, and then all of a sudden be churning out relevant and useful information in like a month or two. But you could have a program set up where they're learning more about the basketball side of things, you're learning more about the statistical side of things, and then over time, it becomes kind of like a feeder program to you. Like that, in general, I think that a lot of decisions in the coaching industry get made kind of short-sighted. I know I would have student managers helping me and probably didn't do a good job of this in terms of training them to help with the video as opposed to telling them what to do to get one thing done.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a hard and whole completely different skill, is being able to delegate and communicate and like lead a staff, especially, you know, if you're not completely clear in what you're trying to accomplish. And when I say that, I'm talking about, you know, I'm imagining myself talking to some math students trying to start a analytics crew without having the first, you know, bit of understanding of what we'd be trying to figure out. So, all right, let's go back to, you know, your experience with Paul Weir and Eric Musselman and then Chris Jans later takes over at New Mexico State and you work for him. What are those three coaches having you look into? What projects are you doing for them? And how are they kind of implementing it into their program and their culture?
Yeah, so this is another question that a lot of people, like you could ask someone who's working in the NBA this question and they're going to give you absolutely no substance, and it makes you question like, are they really doing analytics? Because there's no incentive for them to give any kind of secrets. And that's really just in the reporting of some of this stuff in articles. There isn't much substance given. So I'll try to give some for all three. I guess with Muss, it's no surprise that he's been really big in the transfer market, and you know, gotten great bang for great value out of taking.
Yeah, don't say bang for your buck. That sounds bad on this thing.
yeah, no doubt. Yeah. So he's gotten great value out of taking sit-out guys who might not have committed to University of Nevada out of high school, or if they were grad transfers, they probably would have gotten recruited to high major conferences. And yeah, so one way that we used analytics in the recruiting side of stuff with at Nevada was both to evaluate the transfers. So I was only there for a year, and we were sort of starting to find the right balance for all of this stuff. But one thing that I looked at a lot was how transfers translate in terms of, you know, if you're taking a kid from the NEC, what are reasonable expectations given his usage rate and his efficiency in the Mountain West or whatever the conference is. And I had started to try to put together some kind of like rules around that, which there's definitely always exceptions to the rules. I had some data that did not look well upon MEAC and SWAC transfers. And then, of course, at New Mexico State, Zach Lofton, who came from Texas Southern, was the WAC Player of the Year coming from the SWAC. He was a little bit of an extenuating circumstance because he was also in the Big Ten at one point. So there's some more information about him there. But it definitely does go to show you, you know, there are exceptions to whatever kind of analytic model that you build. So that's one way with the transfers and player evaluations at Nevada. We also had EYBL stats and sneaker circuit stats, and we didn't really use those so much to evaluate the player, but we actually used it as a part of the recruiting process. So on visits, I had a kind of like a tempo-free stats breakdown of their games, and a couple of the players of the recruits really liked that. They actually mentioned it in their, like, when they committed to Nevada, they mentioned analytics in their quotes to our beat writer, which I definitely marketed in order to get future jobs. So that's a way that I don't think necessarily a lot of programs around the country are using, that we did, that was kind of like MUS specific. At New Mexico State, our recruiting was entirely different.
What, anything you can share from, you know, your projects looking into transfers and what translates and what doesn't?
Yeah, so since then, I actually have done this publicly at our Hoop Vision newsletter last summer, which it was like a 4 or 5 part series on transfers and kind of like the statistics behind it. This is not revolutionary, this idea, but as you go up in level, it's usage rate that declines and like pretty consistently, to the point where there was like 2 up transfers in the entire country last season that maintained or increased their usage rate. So to use the NEC to Mountain West example, you know, even the highest of high usage players in the NEC right now, if a Mountain West school is taking them, they should be expected to be a role player. And then I think from there, the question is, how does his skills, and this might be more qualitative, more scouting based, but how does his skills fit the role play, the role that he's going to play in terms of, I don't know, spot up shooting or being switchable on defense and things like that. But the usage rate is going to decrease basically.
What about people who transfer down from a high level to a lower level?
Yeah, it's pretty much the opposite. It's like a what would be called a positive or a negative correlation, where as you transfer down, your usage is going to go up, and efficiency will probably decrease as you're taking on that bigger role. I'm trying to think of a good example, and I'm struggling a little bit, but yeah, it's the type of thing that was, especially when I was actively seeking coaching jobs, there were a lot of my presentation or talks with coaches were literally just trying to show them examples of analytics being more than just shoot a lot of threes, which there right. definitely is that perception.
Sure.
And to me, as a coach, you can disagree with shoot more threes, or you can disagree with a particular thing that's come from analytics. But it's if you start disagreeing with like the process of using data to make better decisions, then that's where I would push back. Like data is definitely a good thing. It's the application that can sometimes be misconstrued for sure. And that's where coaches are very helpful in helping that application. But if you're going to pick a fight against math, I wouldn't suggest that.
and that's a very real deal where people, you know, look down on analytics because I've been coaching for 40 years or whatever. Like I know what I see. Well, that's great. But there are some facts that you can choose to use or not use, you know, and like you said, it's about the implementation. So it really, really curious to hear that Coach Musselman used analytics to evaluate transfers, because, you know, he was a little ahead of his time with the transfer market and it paid dividends for him. And I think transfers is only going to become a bigger and bigger thing in college basketball, especially if, you know, the NCAA allows student athletes to transfer one time without sitting out, which I think they will. And it's going to be an open market and, you know, there's going to be a premium on evaluating transfers. So that's interesting. How were Coach Ware and Coach Jans using analytics? What lens did they kind of look through to implement the analytics you were doing for them?
Yeah. So it was definitely different depending on the coach. And that is another piece of advice that I try to give to staffers that reach out. What can we be doing analytically? My first question is, well, what does your coach value? Or, you know, what makes up his program, I guess. With Paul, he, like I said, he's got the academic background and, I guess, maybe of any coach in the country, like of any head coach in the country, I would say that there's 353 of them. So this is somewhat of a ridiculous statement to make, but you could give him a page full of numbers with very little explanation or visuals or help, and he was going to be okay on his own. So that was definitely a luxury on my end. As the analytics person, a lot of time goes into communication and visualization in order to get the staff or your boss on the same page. And with Paul, you still have to do that, no doubt. But he was very competent, I guess, on his own. And so there was definitely some interesting things that we could do in terms of like even just little projects. This is just not necessarily indicative of what I did on an everyday basis, but this is one that's coming to mind. We had an older team with a lot of guys who had either transferred or gone the JUCO route and had spent a lot of years in college. And so we were a little banged up. And so we started looking at minutes. It was almost like load management, except in college, you don't really have the luxury of actually doing load management. But we started looking at minutes and days off and how productivity in terms of like offensive rating and usage rate changed based off of how much they played the last game. And the issue with this kind of stuff, which is definitely being done at the NBA level, is there's only 30 games in college and there is a small sample size. But it's an example where we were thinking critically about what was our needs as a program or where we were struggling, and then trying to use data to answer questions, which is a unique experience, I think, with Paul.
And did you find anything that's universal? I mean, I guess you just analyzed your own team, but
right.
What did production increase with more rest days or?
Yeah, nothing that I did could be applied as universal, but I think the fact that the NBA has gone in the direction that it's gone is probably pretty good evidence in it of itself that that rest is important. It is a different schedule though in college, and I would imagine that there another area where analytics can play a decent role is in strength and conditioning, and we didn't really do any of that at for either of my three coaches. But I think that there are some strength programs that are using data with like the biometric tracking technology and things like that. And it definitely depends on your resources. But that's just another area where, you know, again, it's not all about shoot more threes.
Okay. And then Chris Jans is like a great defensive mind. His teams are all about toughness and rebounding. Yep. So I'm imagining, I don't know the answer to this, but I'm imagining he had you focus in that area.
Yeah, so don't let Jans fool you. He plays it off as this old school toughness coach, and he absolutely is. But he is a math guy, which was pretty fortunate on my end. So when he was associate head coach at Wichita State, Greg Marshall is not into analytics, at least from secondhand accounts. I don't know Greg Marshall at all. But Coach Jans was actually – he had someone who I think might have worked for the university in another area or something like that who was doing analytics for him, for Jans. And then he would use that information in scouting or to make decisions or not even decisions but to make recommendations to Marshall, and just wouldn't tell him necessarily where it was coming from. So Marshall didn't even really know the analytics were going into that decision-making process. After Jans got the job, as is usually the case, he wanted to bring in his own people, which, that's very common. And I had a sit down meeting with him, and I just kind of based off of his temperament at the beginning of the meeting, I would say I had almost no chance of retaining the job. And I showed him basically a lot of like the recruiting stuff that we had done at Nevada and all these examples. I had this little portfolio put together and he was his temperament changed quite a bit in the meeting. And then fortunately, as you know, it's all about connections as well. So I had a couple people that he knew make calls for me, and basically I was given like almost like a month of a test run to just, as to make sure everything would run smoothly. But yeah, he is a math guy. One thing in practice, we would have drills where we would like count out shooting what we were shooting in the drill, like 12 for 27. And me and one of our GAs picked up on, he's like really good at mental math and calculating the percentage. So definitely better than me at mental math. So that's, I guess, behind the scenes of Jans not just being the old school head coach.
So what type of projects were you doing for Jans?
Yep. So he's a very system oriented coach. I've learned a ton from his system, and without giving too much away in terms of the X's and O's of the system, my big kind of project that summer and fall when he got hired, and he really let me work a lot on this project, was using sports code, again, going back to the performance analyst stuff, to quantify this system. So we had this huge database of basically like his play calls, and it's kind of hard to explain without giving too much of his stuff away. But as you said about the coach with 25 or 30 years of experience who has always done it one way and believes in what he does works, you find that those people are usually pretty right about things. But there's marginal improvements to be made. And actually, even since I've left New Mexico State, he has changed his offense a decent amount. The last project that I did for him before leaving was basically all the like points per possession and efficiency stats of everything we ran and the system as a whole. And then he also had me put about 10 of the top offenses on his computer from the year before. And he, it was almost like an accounting, offensive accounting system. He did make change, and it was not because of me. I mean, I was long gone. But he made some changes to the offense, and I think we might have been more talented my year, but they finished with a higher adjusted offensive efficiency the year after. And so, yeah, it was very system oriented and sports code driven, really.
And you touched on it before, but when people ask you, okay, like what analytics or what stats should we pay attention to in our program? I mean, is it really, what do you guys value? It starts there, or is there, you know, one or two stats that pretty much everyone should be looking at?
Yeah. It is definitely that. That's probably the first place to start, is what do you value? You know, the lowest hanging fruit of, it wasn't even called analytics at first. It was called tempo free statistics. And the lowest hanging fruit was, okay, let's measure things that have always been measured in basketball. You know, rebounding was always measured with rebounding margin, and that's just not the best way to measure it. You know, offensive rebounding percentage and defensive rebounding percentage are more accurate representations of your rebounding ability. That's like maybe the and are you winning more games because you're measuring rebounding better? Maybe not. I had Luke Jaklich on my podcast before the season started, and I think his quote was, what you measure is what gets done. It's what you emphasize gets done. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be measured, but measuring something and then either showing it to the guys or showing it to your coaching staff does have an impact on your psyche and your ability to do that thing. And so why wouldn't you measure it in the best way possible and not use rebounding margin, use percentage instead? That's to me kind of like the lowest hanging fruit. But there's a school like Washington State and Kyle Smith, they've built their program on that. They have what he calls the hustle stats, where they measure everything, not just hustle, but passing and all these things. And then they make playing time decisions based off of that. I would call those incentive stats. That is probably a pretty good place to start for some programs.
Yeah. Is there, I was going to ask you, like you mentioned Moneyball earlier, kind of sparking your interest in analytics. Who's the guy in that? Billy Bean, right?
Yep.
Who's like who would be like the Billy Bean for basketball? Is there one?
The Billy Bean for basketball would be Brad Stevens.
I think.
Yeah. Brad Stevens. All right. Well, I guess it'd be Daryl Morey is who it would be. The Billy Bean of college basketball would be Brad Stevens, but for the NBA, it would be Daryl Morey, the GM of the Rockets. But to stick to college, Brad Stevens hired Drew Cannon, who was he also kind of started in the blogosphere and Twitter. He did some work with Ken Pomeroy. He actually did some work with Dave Tellup on the scouting, and he was doing kind of EYBL stat stuff before it was really a thing to even do that. And Brad Stevens scooped him up as a GA at Butler. And there was a SI article when they went to the Final Four detailing, I mean, what it's one of these articles where it didn't tell you a whole lot, but what it did tell you was some lineup efficiency stuff, which then became pretty popular. And like the first wave of analytics in college basketball was like looking at five man lineups, which I'm not exactly the biggest fan of, but it got the ball rolling, and Drew Cannon wound up moving on with him for the Celtics, at the Celtics. And so I would give it to Brad Stevens. Going to back to back Final Fours and mentioning analytics was big for the business.
Were you fist pumping when that happened?
What year did that? I was still a little bit younger. I don't know. I was definitely excited about it, but also not entirely sure what career wise was going to look like at that point.
So let's talk about Hoop Vision and what you got going on with Hoop Vision Plus. But, you know, you just mentioned, you know, your career and the trajectory. What made you decide to step away from the college game and really focus on Hoop Vision?
So I think I hit on it unintentionally a little bit in terms of when we were having the conversation about sort of the role of the video coordinator and how it's really meant for someone who has the ambitions of getting out on the road. And so that was definitely something that entered my mind, not exactly knowing what the path was going to be for me in college basketball. I am not a salesman, and the recruiting side of things did not interest me. It's not to say that I wouldn't have done it or considered doing it. But I think that I had the entrepreneurial spirit, and really after all three seasons, I considered trying to restart Hoop Vision. I'm glad that I waited a little while longer, because I do think that the experience, especially working for three head coaches, was pretty valuable in terms of being able to cover the sport a little bit better than like we talked about when I was in high school or college. And then, you know, the other thing that we haven't talked about, which I think you might have talked about on a podcast, was just kind of like general stress level and happiness level of working in college basketball. That's not to say that starting your own business and trying to be an entrepreneur isn't stressful. It definitely has its stressful moments. But it was a combination of all things. And I think as I've been out for longer and longer, I am willing to talk about it a little bit more. But that's not to say, you know, I did enjoy my time and did get to do a lot of pretty cool things responsibility wise, and even would be open to potential opportunities in the future. But the entrepreneurial thing has been a lot of fun too.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to everything you just talked about, especially in terms of the stress level, and transitioning to running your own business is not exactly the less stressful route, but there is a little bit more flexibility, and you are your own boss, which comes with its own host of problems and issues. But you know, that's the goal. At least, well, it was for me.
I don't know if you have talked about this recently on a podcast or something, but now I think the one that I listened to, you were pretty fresh off of leaving, and so now you have almost a full season under your belt. What has it been like being out?
Man, you're flipping the table on me.
Yeah,
this is what happens when you invite a podcast host to be a guest. What has it been like being out? Was that your question?
Yep.
I've really, really enjoyed it. I would say there were kind of like, there's been three phases so far. It's still been, I guess, it's been about 7 months. The first phase is like relief and like jubilation. It was weird. It really was like a honeymoon period when I decided to step away. It was like, this is awesome. I got all this time, you know, blah, blah, blah. It was just, it was really neat. Then, you know, you got to start, like, reality sits in, you got to start paying bills, you got to actually figure something out. And the next, like, 3 months were super stressful. I mean, like, they were pretty miserable. I was trying to figure out how to run this business. I felt like I was spinning my wheels. I have no business background or experience. And so I was kind of making myself miserable. And I could see a lot of parallels to, like, what people had talked about, you know, when they get their first head coaching job, you know, all the decisions that you have to make and the stress that that brings and the self-doubt. That was a big part. A lot of self-doubt would creep in, which that's not, like, I'm a pretty positive, optimistic person. Like, if you talk to anybody who knows me, like, well, like, self-doubt would probably be surprising, but that's what I felt more than anything. And that really took a lot out of me. And then I kind of snapped out of that, and realized, like, listen, you just got to slow down. Like, you're not going to be able to do this overnight. Just like anything, it's going to take time. Let's focus on a couple things that we want to do well and build it out from there. And once I did that, which I feel like that was probably around November, I've been a lot happier, and we've actually had a lot more success and have seen a lot more momentum. So, I'm really enjoying it right now. If you asked me 4 months ago, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but yeah, I feel like I'm getting the hang of it and really enjoying it.
Interesting. So I can definitely relate to some of that, but I don't think I had, like, the honeymoon period first leaving. Like,
didn't do it as long as I did.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. that's a very good point. But yeah, the doubt was there from the beginning. Like, I had a lot of ideas, and I wouldn't have left if I didn't think it could work. But I'm also definitely more pessimistic than you, but fairly pessimistic. And so I think I put a lot of expectations on myself to, like, prove that it was the right decision. But I guess, for me, knowing this was another thing, and maybe someone listening to this can relate, who's coaching. I knew that New Mexico State was going to be very good, really, next year or the next year and any year, especially with Jans there and just the kind of their place in the WAC. And so it had occurred to me that Jans could get a job and move on, that might have changed my decision. But I would say after, I don't know, this is year two for me, somewhere around year one, I definitely, that feeling of potential, like, regret definitely left. I root heavily for New Mexico State and don't, you know, like, there's no what ifs at this point, which I'm happy I got past, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. And you are killing it with Hoop Vision. You guys have grown a ton, especially over the last 12 months. Talk a little bit about what you're doing with that and Hoop Vision Plus.
Yeah, so Hoop Vision is the same name as when I was in high school and college. It's the biggest thing is the Twitter account. We have a newsletter, a podcast called Solving Basketball, a YouTube channel, and Hoop Vision Plus launched in October, which we have a free Friday newsletter. Every Friday we've missed 1 week in over a year now. We missed 1 week in April, I guess, of last year. And so that's free to sign up for. And we have, I think I can say, thousands of coaches signed up for that. And then in October, we launched Hoop Vision Plus, which is, there's always a newsletter out on Mondays for Hoop Vision Plus subscribers. Sometimes there's another one or two during the week. And it's aimed towards the most hardcore of the Hoop Vision fans, but also a lot of coaches. There's over 100 Division I staffs signed up for Hoop Vision Plus. It is a weird element where the people that you are writing about are a big part of the audience that is actually reading it. And so, yeah, it's been pretty successful from a Hoop Vision perspective. And if you're interested in analytics or X's and O's at the college basketball level, like I said, the Friday one is free. So sign up for that. And then from there, we'll try to convince you to get into HV Plus.
Yeah. And I would say you do a great job of taking these complex ideas and thoughts and putting them in really digestible pieces of content, because like I mentioned, like I am scared of math, like you said, you shouldn't be. And you know, if you threw up a big spreadsheet and there's a bunch of data on there, I wouldn't know what to look at. But you know, you do a great job of incorporating film into it and really making it easy to understand. How much is it? What's the cost on Hoop Vision Plus?
Yeah, so it's either annual or a monthly subscription. So it's $10 a month. Or if you sign up annually, you get 2 months free, and it's $100 for the whole year.
Oh, that's super cheap. Well worth it. So if people are interested, they can find you hoopvisionhq.com. And the Twitter handle is hoopvision68. Anything else that listeners should pay attention to or follow you at or anything else that you wanted to add?
No, the Twitter account's great. I do sometimes plug the Solving Basketball podcast on podcasts, because obviously the people listening are podcast listeners in general. So that's called Solving Basketball and is available iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. And yeah, I thank you for having me, Adam. I really am a listener. I'm subscribed. So yeah, thank you very much.
All right, before I let you go, you listen to podcasts, and I got to give a shout-out to Matt Elkin, who I talked to last night, and he's like, man, you got to ask your guests for podcast recommendations. Mm. So you're a podcast guy. Which give me a basketball and a non-basketball podcast that you're into.
All right, I'm opening up my app right now here. Let me see. So during the season, my podcast listening is a little bit different than out of season. I do, since I cover college basketball, I do like to stay up on what the national media is talking about, and I try to sort of cover it from that perspective. Inevitably, it's much more coaching focused. But here's one that I think coaches have probably never listened to, and might be worth a listen to getting into analytics. It's called Wharton Moneyball. Wharton Moneyball. It's by, I think it's Penn. Wharton's the business school at Penn. I think they're all Penn professors. It's like a 2-hour, it's really a radio show, but they use it for a podcast, and it's all different sports. They have usually three different guests. I know Todd Golden, who's the coach of San Francisco, has been on it. They don't do a ton of college basketball, but they occasionally do, and I'm sure they do around March Madness. I think one of them has consulted for the Eagles. They do some football stuff, but it's a pretty good balance between the guests they have might have more of the expertise of the sports, and they have the academic statistical background. And I think that it might be a good one for someone trying to get into analytics.
All right, great. Wharton Moneyball. Well, Jordan, thanks so much again, and really enjoyed, you know, learning a little bit more about, you know, what goes on behind the scenes and your background. So again, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Adam. I'm sure I'll see you at the Final Four.
Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches podcast. Just a quick reminder to write us a review on iTunes. Visit the website risingcoaches.com, where you can find all of the news on our latest events, kicking off with the Women's Final Four April 2nd and the Men's Final Four event April 4th. We hope to see you there in New Orleans or Atlanta, and thank you so much for listening.